Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Radio Show through BBS. It is Saturday, June 11th, 2011. I'm going to bring my co-host, James Moffitt, on. Jim, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Chris?
Yeah, good. Recovering.
Yeah.
You know, it's taking time, I've kind of been through a lot over the last, I realized yesterday, it's 5 weeks, yesterday it was, that Karen passed away here, and certainly take time to recover and kind of mourn her properly, and so it brings up a lot.
And I think what happens is that in the initial aftermath with the funeral and everything's going on, at first you're just kind of numb in a sense and you get things, and then it kind of sinks in and you start to realize, oh my God, it you know, you think you're okay, and then you realize, no, I'm not okay at all. It's quite an interesting process, but it's very difficult, and it kind of comes and goes in waves too. That's been my experience.
For sure, exactly. Yeah, like as you say, like when it happened, you're then kind of swept up in, you know, the kind of social aspect of talking to people in the family and dealing with it and dealing with making the funeral arrangements and things like that. And there's kind of a whirlwind, and it kind of carries you through the early part. And then it's over time that it kind of settles in on you more, that like, wow, you know, for me, this is a pretty major loss in terms of losing someone I've spent my last 12 years involved with, you know. So, and dying really, really quite suddenly and unexpectedly, you know, it's kind of, you know, I have to reassess a little bit, like, wow, what do I do in my life? What am I doing, you know, and what to do, you know. So I'm struggling with that and what directions my work should take, and I have to reassess things. And I found, like, through the last weeks, like, Karen and I used to listen to a lot of internet radio, all the kind of different reports and shows on what's going on in the world, and it's like I find, like, I just don't have energy for it at all. It's funny. It's just my heart's not in it, kind of. And it's like so much. You know, at times I'm getting back and listening to some shows, but it's going to take time. And, you know, it was something that Karen and I did together. And in a way, we were very lucky to have each other to do it with, because we supported each other in that and what we studied and researched in that. And it's hard to just follow it up. I mean, I need time to get away from it and do other things. And then I was quite behind, you know, when Karen passed. We were just that day, we were going to start, you know, seeding the garden, and we started up a lot of our garden plants inside this year.
Oh, yeah, nice.
So we had them all inside, and I mean, that's what we were doing on the afternoon that she passed. We were just cleaning up our back room where we have our plants growing. And so I got quite behind in the garden, and you know, it's funny, I've kind of wanted to kind of clean the whole house and catch up in the garden and look after everything, which is kind of what I've been doing the last couple of weeks, and try to refresh and renew the place and try to, and then move forward, you know?
I think that's good, actually, because I think in times of mourning, I think it's kind of a bit of an ingathering of things, and it's good to sort of put things in order and, as you say, to reflect on what what you're doing and where you've been going and what you want to do, you know. I mean, it reminds us all again that, you know, of our mortality, and it causes you to reflect on your priorities, and you know, I think that's the really beneficial thing about death, in a sense, is that it does remind us, like, you know, of sort of the unreality of a lot of things, and does put us more into the frame of mind where we can really look at things with a fresh perspective and with more of an uncluttered mind, in a sense. It's a good time to sort of clear yourself of a lot of things and put them in perspective anyways.
Yeah. Yeah, and I had one bit of good news this week, which, for the past 5 to 6 months, I've worked at a second edition of The Slugs,
yeah.
And which is my book for listeners, which explains aspects of Gurdjieff's book entitled Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. And The Slugs is my book, exposition of Gurdjieff's masterpiece. And I'm just so pleased that this is, sometimes, Jim, when a set of revisions like this took me 5 to 6 months, and after a while it weighs on me. I'm just lucky that I was almost at the completion of it just when Karen passed, but Zeljka over in Croatia kind of put together the final volume here, and I have copies in my hand, or a copy at the moment. Maybe I'll just read the new, just the end credits, or the, from the new version. This is my acknowledgments at the end of the book. On an individual level, I would like to thank Anita J. Mitra for her cover illustration and other prints within The Slugs, as well as for her love and support through 20 years of our studies of such things as the tales. James Moffat, a lifelong friend and fellow seeker after truth, editor, critic, and contributor to my work. Karen T. Hale, who has helped and inspired me to see this book through to its completion, despite the chaos and tragedy we saw around us. Karen passed away unexpectedly on May 6, 2011, after being my friend and sweetheart over the past 12 years. Karen, you will be missed, and your shining example in life inspires me to move forward with our struggles for truth and justice in a world gone mad. Finally, I would like to thank Zeljka Zupanic from Croatia, a gifted designer and sincere soul who has contributed so significantly in bringing this work to fruition in such a splendid fashion. I send my love to you all, special nuts like myself, if you know what I mean. And that special nuts reference, for people who have not heard me speak of that, it is from a story about Gurdjieff, and it's recounted by Fritz Peters, who was his houseboy, and Gurdjieff looked out the window of his institute in France, and there was an oak tree, and he asked a young boy how many acorns there were on the tree and on the ground around the tree, and there were thousands and thousands of them. And then he asked Fritz Peters, how many of those acorns or those nuts would become oak trees? And Fritz Peters answered, of course, well, maybe just a handful, maybe none. And then Gurdjieff says to Peters, yes, we must understand human possibilities by understanding nature. And he says, similarly, everybody has the potential to become an oak tree or develop these latent faculties of the spiritual soul. But most people don't, and life can pass us by without the fulfillment of those possibilities. And Gurdjieff described most of the acorns or the nuts then just become fertilizer and create the possibility of future life. So the idea of when I'm saying special nuts, that's I'm referring to that Gurdjieff story. Yeah, so I'm pleased with that, like, kind of note to Karen in this book, because she, you know, I look back, she was with me the last 5 to 6 months while I worked at this, and she helped with it quite a bit and went through and checking all my quotes and reading sections and such. So I'm very pleased with this new edition of The Slugs, Jim. It's so interesting. I have a whole... it was 5 sections. I've added 80 pages to it.
Yeah, you were saying before that you'd added quite a substantial amount of material. That's a lot.
Yeah, and I have new chapters. I go through, like, Beelzebub's first visit to Earth, his second visit, the third, fourth, and fifth, and the sixth. I give a an overview of what each of his visits entailed, like the main things he did, and I have chapters on, like, the degeneration of religions, which is a theme through the book of how different genuine religious teachings of what Gurdjieff or Beelzebub calls individuals actualized from above. And he's kind of like Saint Buddha, and he calls them Saint Lama and Jesus Christ and Saint Moses and Saint Mohammed. So Gurdjieff talks about the different religions and how the degeneration of the teachings of these genuine messengers, how that occurs over time, like the different forces that impact upon that. And I have another whole chapter on what he calls the scientists of new formation and the beings of the learned beings of new format. Gurdjieff has kind of derogatory terms to describe science, which he's characterizing, it's kind of materialistic, soulless science is what his critique is of, because he's not critical of the objectives of science, and in fact Gurdjieff is explaining certain principles of what he calls objective science, but he's saying the learned beings of new format, they've kind of lost these ancient teachings. And a lot of what is then produced is kind of superficial and what he would call formatory. And then I have chapters on even one on the future of humanity, and I have a whole section now on the processes of reciprocal self-destruction. And Beelzebub's tale is a fascinating story, and it's amazing, Jim, when I look back at when I first put together The Slugs, you know, about 7 to 8 years ago. And firstly, it was a set of notes from Psychological Illusions. And I started taking the material I had on Beelzebub's tales out of Psychological Illusions and replicating it into a separate book, which then I developed, over the past 7, 8 years. But it's interesting to note that the early versions of the book, they focus completely on, like, the themes of the psychopathology of the human psyche, the science of the soul outlined in the tales, and the principles of objective science outlined in the tales. And that includes, like, the laws of 3 and 7, or principles of creation. And in the first versions of that book, I really hadn't appreciated how much the book was a commentary on the nature of war, historically and contemporary-wise, in the history of humankind. And Beelzebub's, he's observing the planet Earth from the planet Mars through a telescope. And he observes these processes of war occurring on the planet. And that's one of the main themes of Beelzebub's tales. And it's amazing to me, Jim, in a way, it took me 15 years to kind of realize that. I think because my interest was on the esoteric psychology and the normal, like, psychopathology of humankind, I think you must have seen that development, in the last edition of The Slugs, but it's even more so in this edition.
Yeah, it's funny because, I think I had a very different impression of it. I think I saw that as being like a major, when the first time I read Beelzebub's Tales, I think was, I would guess about 1978, perhaps, 78, 79, around that point. And at the time, I was quite interested in what was happening in terms of the nuclear threat. And when I started writing my first book about the Fourth Way and about our experiences and things, I wanted to sort of relate that to the contemporary nuclear situation. So I think I saw that as being like a major, major theme, as like that it was really an anti-war. It's an anti-war book, but to even say that is kind of... It doesn't really capture how deep it goes, because it's what it really relates to is the unnaturalness of the psyches of the three brain beings of the planet Earth, and how war is kind of the ultimate expression of that unnaturalness. That's the way I understood the book and saw that I saw that as a major kind of theme of the book.
Well, that's really interesting, and I think that shows the difference between yourself and myself. I think in our orientation and background at the time, because you were much more knowledgeable of, like, history and the wars and politics and such, whereas I tended to be much more naive and isolated concerning that, those types of, those areas. Well, so that's really interesting that did strike you early on.
I think one of the things, too, is that, and I, I'm trying to think exactly the timing of this, but I do believe at that point that I may be kind of confabulating this a little bit, but well, actually probably not, because it was a little bit after that. It was around that time anyway that I read Henry Miller's essay "Murder the Murderer," which is an anti-war essay that he wrote, which I think is really like the most profound anti-war statement that I've ever read outside of Beelzebub's Tales. And that's why it kind of really struck me as like, wow, like the two of them together, what they say about war is like really so much, it sort of makes a mockery of all the kind of superficial pronouncements that people have about wars and about, the history of, and the history of wars is all kind of on superficial political, social, economic, external manifestation level of explanation, whereas like Miller's explanation of his anti-war essay is deeply psychological, and it's really quite profound because he utters all these heresies in his essay, but everything that he says, basically he wrote it, he began it at the beginning of the Second World War and completed it at the end of the Second World War. It's in two parts. Everything he says has come true, and I was trying to square that with, well, how can somebody be such a heretic and be so correct about things? Well, the reason why he's correct about things is because he doesn't buy into the superficial, pat, conventional wisdom explanations about war and doesn't buy the justifications for it. He's just opposed to it, and he sees it as a disease of the psyche, and that's what Gurdjieff explained in incredible detail. And really, the great thing about Gurdjieff is he's talking about in Beelzebub's Tales, is he's talking about this, but he does it on so many different levels. He does it, very funny the way he presents it. The standard, we've talked about this before in the program, but the standard explanation about how Beelzebub is watching the Earth and through his telescope, and he sees somebody in one spot, and then there's this puff of smoke, and then somebody in another spot falls down, and that's sort of the invention of gunpowder and of guns, And when he's describing it, it's like he has this way of creating this distance between the reader and what human beings are. It's very, very odd how he's able to achieve that. He assumes the voice, he appropriates the voice of an alien intelligence, and he makes you look at human beings as if you were an alien intelligence. So it gets you out of a lot of your identifications with your normal understanding and knowledge of things, and lets you see things more objectively, and you realize kind of how ridiculous things are, and you realize the truth and the lies and so many the truth of matters and the lies and the explanations with which we legitimize our violence and our peculiar psychic manifestation that leads us to kill beings similar to ourselves. So it's an amazing achievement in terms of how he creates these effects and how he carries that off. And it runs through the whole book. It's quite amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, his style of writing and the way he characterizes human beings and their motives is amazing. Like, he's a master, a word master.
It's a bit like, too, it's like the way, I mean, again, you know, we talked about the tales, you know. Well, what is a tale? And it's like, it's a bit like the Thousand and One Nights, you know, like Scheherazade's tales. So he's telling these stories, and somehow in telling these stories, there's an accumulation of a perspective that he's developing. It's very different from like modern writing. There's something quite timeless about the way he presents this, and he's telling these tales to his grandson. You know, it's like you tell a story to children to keep them amused and informed, and about things that interest them and evoke their curiosity. And the thing that evokes his grandson's curiosity most is us, the three brain beings of the planet Earth, or as he likes to refer to them, the slugs.
And your favorite.
And your favorite.
Beelzebub always refers to them as your favorite when he's talking to Hussein.
Our egocentrism, and our kind of our the way humans are so full of themselves in terms of their great achievements and everything, and yet this guy's looking at us and calls us a slugs, and he says to his grandson, Beelzebub says to his grandson, he calls them your favorites, but it's so insulting. It's kind of hard to explain when he says that your favorites. Kind of like, you know, kids have fascination for rocks and, you know, ant farms and like
dinosaurs,
things that are really insignificant, and that's us.
Yeah.
Which is it's very amusing though the way he keeps reinforcing that. And then at one point when Beelzebub's grandson refers to human beings as slugs, he tells them, you know, do you realize what would happen to you if you insulted them in that way? Like, you know, they'd be on you and they'd commit all sorts of violent acts against you. It's like it's really highly amusing the way he just keeps hammering home how our psyches are so degenerated and we don't attain a level of objective reason and objective conscience. So we're really basically at a very low level of being existence. And yet he explains, like, the story he tells, it's a real tragedy, like something has really befallen humanity and we're not what we should be, which creates this great tension, because he's, you know, on one hand he's saying, you know, it's not just like he's excoriating the humankind or that he's detailing all our faults, but he's saying, you know, it could and it should be much different for people. Like they have the possibility, like to not just become fertilizer and go back into the ground, but to become actually majestic oak trees. You know that they have this seed. They have this seed of something which is much greater in themselves, but that they're malformed, and so they end up being something quite different from what they really should be.
Yeah. He describes human beings like we have the potential for coding higher being bodies for the life of the soul, and that is what is natural to three-brained beings who have these latent faculties of what he called the Kesjan body and the kind of mental spiritual body. So we have the potential to develop these higher being bodies. But then Gurdjieff explains, though, that most people don't live and actualize these possibilities. Instead, he says, they live and die according to the same principle as governs the life of one- and two-brained beings. So And in that case, Gurdjieff says, when a person dies, they feed the moon and they feed the earth, but they don't maintain their own individuality. So their cosmic possibilities are lost. It's like the nuts that become fertilizer and go back into the ground. And how unnatural this is. And it's a fascinating book. The way I see it now, I think it's the most profound book that I know of on the psychopathology of the world elites, in a way. Not only of the elites, but Gurdjieff discusses a lot the role of what he calls hasnamasses, or hasnamas. And it's his own kind of invented term. I'm trying to look for any derivations of this term, Jim, or any meaning that we might... You were saying hasnamas is like has no mass.
Yeah,
because Gurdjieff often refers to people who he calls terrestrial nullity. Like they kind of don't develop anything in themselves, so they're kind of empty.
Yeah.
But the main feature of a hasnamas is that they lack the divine impulse of conscience.
Yeah.
And it's a remarkable concept. Like, in psychology, it's most similar to what you might call psychopaths, who lack the capacity for empathy or compassion or love for other human beings. And they can do things without conscience. And in fact, the famous psychologist Robert Hare, who's Canada's top researcher on psychopathology, his book was entitled Without Conscience. Is that what it was? That's right, eh, Jim?
I don't know. I don't know that book.
Oh, yeah, that's what it was called, Without Conscience. That was his last book on explaining.
Wow.
So it corresponds exactly with this hasnamas, lacking the divine impulse of conscience. But that he also portrays them as being like mama and papa's darlings, and as kind of being pampered and having these kind of inflated ideas of themselves. And it's like he talks about the adverse effects of education, but the adversity of education is even more pronounced, he says, among the elites, I guess, because they get a particular emphasis in their education. But just coming back, so it's not just, they're not, hasnamas isn't just a psychopath, but it's also people who are very like childish and egocentric. And this is part of what Gurdjieff is saying in whole of Beelzebub's tales. He's saying that there's a false egoism and a false consciousness system which forms among the three-brained beings on planet Earth. And their true consciousness passes into what they would call their subconsciousness. So Gurdjieff explains that the sacred being impulses of faith, hope, and love, and the capacity for remorse of conscience, these pass into the subconscious. And instead there's this crystallized egoism that replaces what should be the true consciousness. So it's all a very brilliant kind of model, a bit, of the difference between consciousness centered in the mind, which is a product of conditioning and socialization and formatory ideas, versus the deeper human consciousness connected to the heart and to the sacred being impulses. And there's kind of that dichotomy. And the masses of humankind have become dominated by this false consciousness system. So it's the hasnamasses, they would include psychopaths, but not all hasnamasses are psychopaths. They can also be very vain or egoistic or self-centered individuals. There's different types of hasnamasses. But Beelzebub provides a very interesting analysis of the Hasnamasses, and then he has material on, he talks about the League of Nations. Like at one point, his grandson Hassan asks him, why can't they eradicate these horrific processes from their planet? Like, doesn't anyone realize how terrible these things are, how arch-criminal they are? And Beelzebub then launches into kind of a critique of how societies like the League of Nations form and why nothing's ever accomplished by them. And he talks about their special societies, as he describes it, special societies for power-possessing beings. And it's an absolutely fascinating description. And I didn't want to get too much into Beelzebub's tales, Jim, today, because I don't know if I should send you a copy of this book or get you to order it, or if you're going to be up this way, I'll just deliver it to you if you're up within the next while. Because I would like for you to see this and have a little bit of time with it. And then we started going into the tales, but I'd like to go into in more detail and with quotations what we've just touched upon now. I'd like to do that, but with maybe two shows or two or three shows from now.
Yeah, sure. Sounds good.
Yeah, and we should go, but you should bring up some of Henry Miller at some point and go through some of that sometime too when we go into.
Yeah.
We'll talk about the causes of war from the perspective of Beelzebub's tales.
Yeah. It's such a, as you say, there's different aspects to all this too, is like, because he also, it's in the broader context where he talks in the earlier parts of the book about how these different saintly messengers have come to the earth and have tried to engender paths for humans to develop conscience and to develop what should be properly theirs, and how their psyches are degenerated and they haven't really been able to incorporate or to enact these messages that these messengers have brought them, and it's like there's this constant influx of higher influences into life on Earth, but they don't have any effect. Like, they have transitory effects, like they take hold, but then they're rooted out. So it's like there's this constant struggle going on to try to overcome it. Like, there's this constant influx, or this ongoing influx of higher influences, but it seems like people just can't incorporate it because of their psyches.
Yeah.
Generation of their psyches, and that's kind of like the backdrop to everything, is that the psyches are so degenerated and that they're so malformed that they're so I'm trying to think of something other than degenerated, but there's a displacement in the psyche, which is the pathology, which has to be overcome, and which is constantly being addressed by these higher influences who want to lift people up, who want to lift humanity up, but it just doesn't occur. It's very interesting because it provides a completely different perspective on history and on the history of war, on the history of religion, on the history of everything, really, and
mm-hmm.
It's quite fascinating. One thing I was just going to say was about the slugs and about Beelzebub's tales is that, if you really look, it's very peculiar, actually. I think this is a very odd thing, that if you look at all the literature on Beelzebub's tales, there just really isn't all that much out there in terms of commentary. It's very peculiar to me
it is.
Yeah. And so that I think this is probably, the slugs is probably the most substantial work that I know in terms of commenting on. Like, there's smaller things. Like, Bennett has some commentary. If you look in C.S. Knott's book, one of his books, he has some excerpts from Orge's commentaries on Beelzebub's tales. And as I say, I know that there's somebody wrote a doctoral thesis on Beelzebub's tales, but I think that was in terms of literature. I'm not sure, what the emphasis is in the book, but there really isn't that much out there. Very peculiar that such a an important work. In a sense, I get it, because it's such a difficult work to interpret. You have to have such a preparation in order to be able to really, really understand it to any significant degree and to be able to comment on it. But still, you would have, I would have thought that there would have been more out there by this point. So again, it's your book is really quite unique in that respect. If anybody has an interest in the book, they should definitely read The Slugs. I think it's, you know, the original version I thought was very, very good. So I look forward to the expanded version too.
It's amazing when you think of it. Like, I guess I've written two explanatory books here. One on Blavatsky's secret doctrine, and the other on Gurdjieff's Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, which I would say are two of the most important occult esoteric books of the past century. I'm not sure what else would stand up there with those two classic books. I mean, there are other major works like the Urantia work, which I've never tried to tackle yet, but I'd like to come to. But in a way, these are the most, like Manly Hall described Blavatsky's secret doctrine as, quote, undoubtedly the magnus opus of the literature of the modern world. And what amazes me is if you went to the edgy university system, I wonder if there is any university in North America where you actually get exposed to the secret doctrine or Beelzebub's tales. And my expectation is that they wouldn't be. I've never heard of it, even though, I've never heard of it. It's amazing, like, how these two books are so completely ignored. It's astonishing. Like, here you have Manly Hall saying, you know, this is undoubtedly the magnus opus of the literature of the modern world and about the secret doctrine. And it's an amazing book. Book one deals all with the creation of the universe, and book two deals all with the origin and evolution of humanity. So it's this broad, like, sweeping book that gives you a whole alternate view of the nature of reality and human existence and everything. And yet these books, it's like they're completely ignored. Were you ever exposed, Jim, to any of such influences through your university studies?
I think maybe when I was at Carleton University in graduate school, I think there was a guy there, Roger Wells, personality theory, and who I taught a course on self theories, and I think we had some Sufi material. I mean, we definitely had some material, and I think we maybe had a few excerpts from Gurdjieff, but nobody really taught the book. And I think you would be right. If either of those books is taught, I guarantee you they're not taught in the psychology department.
Yeah.
They might be taught in literature, like Gurdjieff might be taught in some sort of, you know, experimental literature program, might teach it. And the secret doctrine might be taught in philosophy, but I doubt it. I mean, I highly doubt it. And it's like the esoteric scholar, Jocelyn Godwin, who studies theosophy, says that Madame Blavatsky knew more about occult philosophy than any person alive. And I mean, I'll go you one better in the sense that I think you've written three books, actually, because, I mean, Psychological Illusions it deals with some of the fourth way and Gurdjieff material from Beelzebub's Tales, but a large part of it is derived from In Search of the Miraculous, a new spec version of Gurdjieff's teaching, which is Gurdjieff prior to the Russian Revolution in Russia speaking to his pupils, and there you get a completely different presentation and emphasis of his teaching. To me, I would say the most important book of my life. You said, what's the most important book in your life? I mean, there's no question it's In Search of the Miraculous. It's like the most important book I've ever read, because I've read it five or six times, and every time I read it, I find new things, and I think there's there's more truth in that book than anything I've ever read. I don't know if I understand enough of Beelzebub's tales to you know, it would have an even greater impact if I was better prepared to understand it. But it's certainly like a great book, and the same with The Secret Doctrine. I've only read parts of The Secret Doctrine. I haven't read it in its entirety, but it's a brilliant book. So that's like three books that you've explained or provided commentaries on. And I would say, like, if I was going to teach a course on psychology in the university, I would have those would be my three textbooks. I mean, that's the beginning of everything, really.
Yeah, it's just so immensely valuable.
And if I was doing a syllabus, I would have the Heart Doctrine on it for sure.
Yeah.
It's funny.
I tend to see the Heart Doctrine as my most important book because of how I see it showing this common teaching to the different world religions, and I think that's really important because in external society, like, religions are portrayed as causing animosity and dissension and conflict between people. But I think what we have to realize, this is the distortion of religions that leads to that. It's not what the esoteric teachings of the religions are, because they share this common teaching of the heart. But it's such an alternate model of consciousness that, yeah, it kind of raises... it's amazing. I mean, there's never any kind of scientific reaction or response to anything of my work. It's like sometimes I feel I live life in the vacuum, you know?
It's kind of weird, but... it's interesting though, because I think in the mainstream, like I said, I'm going to send you. Unfortunately, we sort of have a bit of a postal strike going on here in Canada, which is not a full strike, but delivery slowed up. I bought that book, Consciousness Beyond Life, by Dr. Pim van Lommel.
Excellent.
And I mean, you're really going to like his book, and I think he would like the Heart Doctrine. He is a cardiologist, because he really argues that the idea that the brain generates consciousness just isn't accurate. Like, it's just not, you know, it just has to be abandoned. And the near-death experience research clearly shows that just can't be right. You know, I think that there are more and more people, it's still not in the mainstream, but I think there's more and more people who are coming around to like a different perspective.
Yeah.
So it may just be a fact you're just a little too far ahead of the curve on this one. But I mean, again, I just think it's, if you look at everything we know about the mind and from all sources, and I just don't see how you can make any kind of an informed commentary without studying esoteric and mystical teachings on these subjects. It just seems like obvious to me that the current conventional Western psychological and philosophical perspective which is really an assumption, is that the brain generates consciousness, and that it's the material processes in the brain which create the experience of consciousness and the contents of consciousness. That's just not right. I mean, like, I think the evidence is overwhelming that that's totally not right.
Yeah, and there's absolutely no evidence for it.
Well, yeah.
And they can't define what consciousness is. Sorry?
It's just like, it's so weird, you know? I heard Dennett on the radio a little while ago again. It's like, you know, this guy's completely delusional. He really is, you know. It's amazing how this, it's like, you know, these ideas. That's one of the things that Gurdjieff really makes fun of people, human beings, in Beelzebub's tales, is how any old tale sort of becomes established as some sort of understanding of things, and then everybody repeats it, and everybody believes it, and then everybody makes it, they pontificate and wiseacre, as he says, shamelessly about these things, but nobody seems to question whether or not the original idea is actually correct. And I mean, I would say that the idea that life comes from inanimate, dumb matter, which, you know, nobody can actually explain, or that consciousness is generated by the material processes of the brain which are not mindful, that just makes no sense to me. Like, it doesn't make sense to me on a lot of levels, but now what I know from people who have really studied consciousness, which is the people in the esoteric tradition, I think it's completely ridiculous.
Yeah, there's certainly no evidence for it. And you see how people in the consciousness literature, they don't make any effort to deal with the direct kind of experiential aspects of consciousness.
Yeah.
Like, they talk about it, but it's always in kind of an abstracted way. Whereas if you approach consciousness, I think, from the Gurdjieff perspective and the Heart Doctrine perspective, it's much more in touch with our own inner experiencing and our own inner awareness of being. Like, the theoretical psychologists and neuroscientists, they don't deal with, like, the experiential reality of consciousness. So their comments aren't grounded in that. And another thing that strikes me is that I think one of the most damaging kind of concepts was the emergence in the 70s of this left brain, right brain dichotomy that came about in psychology as a consequence of the split brain research of Sperry, and which kind of showed that there was a certain independence of the two hemispheres of the brain in terms of what processes they specialized in. And the left hemisphere traditionally is regarded as kind of rational, sequential, logical, whereas the right hemisphere is seen as holistic, gestalt, perceptual. And it ended up that everybody kind of like think, oh, you have kind of normal consciousness in your left side of your head, and you got this kind of mystical or paranormal consciousness in the right side of the brain. And so everyone, you know, you have to learn to draw from the right side of the brain, and you have to develop both sides of your brain. And I think that led people to think that, you know, the problem is that we're too left brain and we have to develop the right brain. But as though all these different states of consciousness are just all up in the head, just depending on what side of the brain you're using. And in a way, that leads to such confusion, because I don't think that the main distinction is between left brain, right brain. I think it's between the brain and the head versus the heart. And that's to understand consciousness, we need to understand that far more than the left brain, right brain dichotomy. And this isn't to deny that there's not validity to that. Like, I know, for instance, my mom had a stroke, and it affected, my mom was left-handed, so her stroke affected her right hemisphere, which happened to be her hemisphere for verbal linear. So my mom lost her speech because of a right hemisphere, but that, it's usually the left, but my mom happened to have reverse dominance. But anyway, so my mom struggles even to be able to say a few words. But if I were to say to my mom, Jim, and I've done this, I demonstrated at the hospital to the doctor, I could say to my mom, hickory dickory, and she'd say, doc, the mouse ran up the clock. And I could, if I repeated a nursery rhyme, she can say whole sentences.
Wow.
In the completion of verbal, like, rhymes like that. So whereas if she's trying to intentionally say words, she can't do it and can't sometimes even formulate one or two. But if I, you know, row, row, row your boat and then turned it over to her, she'd say gently up the stream, and she can respond in that way. So there you can clearly see kind of like she still has this faculty for rhyme. And see, that is normally what would be regarded as a right hemisphere, like music, whole, like, gestalt patterns. But anyway, so it's not, there are different cognitive faculties associated with left and right hemispheres, but that dichotomy does not at all deal with the deeper issues of states of consciousness. And I think that really misled people for a long time, Jim, that I remember Marcel Kinsborn, a very famous neuroscientist, he called it dichotomania, that everybody kind of thought half of everything was in one hemisphere and the other half was in the other hemisphere. He called it dichotomania, and so I think that took people off a bit. And even today, I hear that so much among people. They say, "Oh yeah, you've got to just develop the right side of your brain."
Well, I mean that, you know. Yeah, I mean, I was so wildly overblown. I think that's actually one of the areas where I realized, like, for me, when you began critiquing that research in the 70s, one thing that really struck me was that you used, like, Gurdjieff's Law of Three. That was an application to the psychological knowledge, and which really struck me as being a really good application, is that Gurdjieff says that he calls it formatory thinking is mechanical thinking. It's thinking based on pre-recorded or taped or conditioned ideas and how we tend to repeat things. And there are a lot of things that the formatory center is good for. Like, you don't want to think or deliberate about what the capital of Venezuela is or what the formula is for calculating mass and acceleration or you know what 2 times 6 is. You don't those things, you want to know those things by rote, but the problem is that so much of what passes for thinking is the formatory center. It's just we have these conditioned ideas and attitudes and opinions and beliefs about things, and then we just you say something and people will give you these automatic responses, and we all do this, and it's like it's such a part of what passes for thinking. And he says there are various characteristics to formatory thinking. Formatory thinking often involves such telltale phrases as nothing but or nothing more than, as if the level of explanation completely explains something, and most distinctly that it's thinking of the least resistance and thinking that always involves two. So what you have in terms of conceptualizations of things is that you have a dichotomous formulation of anything. So on the one hand you have this, and on the other hand you have that, and it always involves people identifying some aspect of something and then taking its opposite, or what people allege is its opposite, and thinking that that leads to a complete understanding of things. And I think, like in relationship to the left brain, right brain research, I mean, there's no question that the left brain and the right brain are differentiated in terms of structure and function. I mean, and there's all sorts of areas in the brain. If you damage that area of the brain, you're going to lose functional capacities. There's no question of that. But it's also no question that the brain is much more plastic, and that we're not, this is something that drives me crazy, we're not hardwired. We're not computers. You know, we're human beings, and we're completely different. There isn't any cute computer that regenerates its structure over periods of time. All of the molecules in your body, all of the cells, all of the structure, all of the physical structures in your body are being regenerated. There isn't any computer that's true of. So people should stop calling us computers. We compute, but we're not computers. So,
well, that's just to hold you up there, Jim. Yeah. That's really interesting you say that. And it's interesting. If you look back on the Gurdjieff teaching, Gurdjieff didn't compare man to a computer, but in his day, back in the 1920s, it was man as machine.
Yes, yeah.
And that was the kind of model in psychology, man as machine. And then, like you're saying, the computer model, so then it was like man as computer. And it's interesting because the analogies don't really work. In ways they do, but
and ways we are machines. I mean, the mechanistic metaphor comes from the 17th century and from the beginning of it's Descartes and the influence of Descartes and the Newtonian mechanics of the clockwork universe and everything. But to get back to the, like just this idea of the formatory center. So So on the one hand, you have this, and the other hand, you have that. And I realized, like Gurdjieff says, that we're third force blind, that we don't see that there's always a third force. Everything exists in twos, he says, to our normal waking consciousness. We see things in twos, but there's always a third element. And so sometimes it's the medium in which something exists, and sometimes it's the relationship that exists between the parts, and sometimes, often, it's a third force which is invisible because he says we're third force blind. We can't recognize it. And I think in terms of like the left brain right brain research, it was so overblown. And you did a critique of Robert Ornstein, a psychologist who wrote a book, The Psychology of Consciousness. And in there, he talked about the left brain right brain, and he put forward like his tentative dichotomous organization or a tentative dichotomous structural functional organization of the brain, and he had all these lists of attributes and their putative opposites and one would be in one side of the brain and the other would be other. But then he had things like the moon and the sun and people, as Marcel Kinsporn correctly observed, they were sort of they had this dichotomy mania. I said they were in the throes of split brain research fever, you know, because they were just completely out of their minds in terms of like trying to assign everything. And your critique was like, are these things all really reducible? That was the problem, is they're trying to reduce them to these two parts of the brain.
Yeah, I remember one example of that was when he says that, like the difference between your reason versus what you know in your heart. So it was like he was putting reason in the left hemisphere, and he was putting the heart in the right hemisphere. Like, it was absurd. Like,
and then at one point, Ornstein also had as the opposite of intellect, and this is the verbal analytic component of all this. He had as the opposite of intellect, he had sensation, but he also had intuition and passion as being the opposite. And you said,
yeah.
So does that mean that sensation equals intuition equals passion? I mean, it's absurd. Like, you know, it just doesn't stand up to any kind of comprehensive analysis. But the bigger problem too is like I noticed that Rupert Sheldrake uses this term, and I've been using it for a long term, and I don't know if I got it from him or if it's just like we got it from somebody else or we just independently came to it. But when I read most psychological commentaries on consciousness, it's like human beings are like these disembodied beings, right? Their brains, and it's all about the brain, and there's no mention like that the whole of the human body is an instrument of consciousness. It's just so obvious if you have a perspective that's not rooted in the dominant model at this time, and that's what I think the big failing. Like you say, there's no mention of the heart, and there's no mention of the, like in Gurdjieff terms, is there's the heart, and then there's the whole spinal column and the what he calls the moving brain, which he says is centered in the spinal column. And I mean, we have all these subsystems in the body, which are these amazingly complex systems, and they're not all, they communicate with the brain, but they're not all directed by the brain. Like, the brain isn't the master system that people seem to want to say everything is in your brain, like all your emotions are in your limbic system. Well, your limbic system is related to your emotions, there's no question of that, but are your emotions really in your limbic system? I would say no. You would obviously say no. I mean, from our perspective, that's absurd. So the bigger question is, it's interesting because I'm just sort of writing about this now, is that various people like R.D. Lang and Theodore Roszak and Ken Wilber have all kind of commented in different pieces about what happened in terms of, like, when Galileo, it's interesting, it's always portrayed like Galileo's struggle with the church was the triumph of reason and rationality over dogmatic religious belief. But the other part of the Galileo story is that Galileo basically Galileo said, what isn't measurable isn't real, and everything external is primary, and everything internal is secondary. And so the effect of that was that basically R.D. Lang says that all interior dimensions were done away with because of that. So it wasn't just like spirit, like Wilbur says, it wasn't just spirit that was a casualty of that, it was all qualities of consciousness. And with that went the idea that consciousness could be examined by studying our own experience, which is the essence of the esoteric tradition. So you have this complete debasement of the value of studying internal processes, and Rozak says is that because of that, he says that, this is a quote, he says that the problem which has confounded Western philosophy since Descartes is a direct consequence of the fact that, quote, we have grown so peculiarly stupid about the way that experience really happens. And he says, like in modern psychology, people don't study experience, they collapse. They study data points and they collapse things into aggregate statistics, but they don't really study themselves. They certainly don't study themselves systematically, and they don't put any value on trying to understand the interior nature of our being. It's all based on external observation of behavior and extrapolation of interior qualities from external behavior. And I mean, even in psychology, the behaviorist position dominated psychology for 40 or 50 years, but even behaviorism came to the realization, well, you can't ignore thoughts and feelings because they're kind of important to defining what psychology and what human beings are, but everything is still so really superficial compared to, for instance, the esoteric tradition, and that's been the casualty of the last 300 years in science, is that we've seen human beings as being essentially machines, and now you hear a lot of talk that we're biocomputers, but we're not really machines. We do things mechanically. We're not really biocomputers. We do compute, and we're not really holograms, you know, but we do have holographic properties, you know, and that's the danger of all these metaphors. It's like at one point in your work you were talking about Bohm and about his holographic model, and you said, you know, you have to be careful about extrapolating things from higher dimensions and using them to describe things in lower dimensions and vice versa. It's like, you know, there are different principles here operating, and we have to kind of remember that, I think, sometimes when we're trying to come up with, you know, comparisons as to how things work. You know, like I say, we do compute. There's no question we compute. We can be considered to be machines in some ways. Like in a lot of ways that those metaphors work, and even in terms of the hologram. But it's, you know, these are all metaphors, and we're none of those things. You know, humans are quite much more complex than that, and distinct from that.
Yeah. Yeah. Just returning to one aspect of what you were saying. Concerning the tendency in of the formatory apparatus, which is what Gurdjieff calls the mechanical part of the intellectual center, to always construe things dualistically. And I remember, like you were referring to my early writing on that, and I mean, at the time, like psychology was totally awash with that kind of dualistic stances, because there was the conscious and the unconscious, stimulus response, input output, all the different dichotomies of different personality dimensions, and then all these distinction between logical versus discursive thought, and all these different distinctions, and all these philosophers and psychologists, all with their own favorite dualities. And it was amazing, because when I saw how widespread was the tendency to always construe things dualistically, that's what provides real keen insights into what Gurdjieff is trying to explain with the law of three, where he says we're third force blind. And I found that any time I took a duality of modern thought, if you looked a little further, you could, you know, figure out a triunity in it. Like you do have left brain, right brain, but then you have the corpus callosum, which interconnects them and mediates them. You know, another example I remember was a stimulus response psychology. And in a way, see, it sounds as though you could have a stimulus at one point in time which leads to a subsequent response. But really, that's not what occurs, because a stimulus is not a stimulus unless there's a response to it.
Exactly.
So the stimulus, you can't have a stimulus and then a response, because it's not a stimulus. See, in a way, what happens is the stimulus and response and organism are like three aspects of one that occur together. And it's only in our mind we differentiate two aspects of that. But we never see it. You can never see a stimulus apart from a response, because then it's not a stimulus. It's only a stimulus because of eliciting a response.
And you can't have a stimulus or response without an organism to mediate.
Yeah, because exactly. So really what you have, it's more what's called the Hegelian dialectic, because Hegel saw things as moving triads.
Right.
And he called it thesis,
no.
Antithesis, and then synthesis.
Yeah.
So, and Hegel didn't see them as separate, but he saw reality as involving these moving triads. And that's how Gurdjieff would encourage us to see it, to see, to recognize third force in phenomena. And so it was like that. It was seeing the dualistic thinking of everybody, not just in psychology and philosophy, but just in general, in life, seeing the dualistic thinking that really helps to highlight the significance of the concept of the law of three. And you see some examples like in psychology was defined as the science of behavior and the mind. Okay, dualistic, the mind and the body. Whereas in the Gurdjieff teachings, there's head, heart, and hands. There's head, the heart, it stands for the emotional center, and the hands, the physical. So we function mentally, emotionally, and physically, not just mentally and physically. You see, so whenever they had a duality, it's like they're missing, like Gurdjieff describes us as three-brained beings on planet Earth. Whereas in modern psychology, you'd think we were just two brain beings, like the brain and the body. So that's one very important example. And another important example in physics was everybody kind of thinks, because of Einstein, now we believe that all energy can be converted into matter and matter can be converted into energy. And we have the duality of matter and energy. Whereas in the newer physics, what they now recognize is information as third force. And there's information fields latent within space itself. So the new physics is not third force blind, because the new triunity is matter, energy, and intelligence. And we see that even going back to the ancient Vedas of India, the three modes of nature, or the three gunas. And they represented intelligence, rajas, passion, and tamas, mass, or inertia. So you find some examples where that threefold analysis is really just so important, and it escapes so many people. So anyway, we were talking about the kind of dualities of dualistic thinking, and there was something else I had wanted to respond to in what you were saying, but it skipped my mind at the moment.
Yeah, and I was trying to think, how do we start talking about the left brain, right brain? I think it went back to we were talking about esoteric teachings and how they're not taught
that's good. Yeah, it brings us right back. We were talking about how the secret doctrine and Beelzebub's tales, like these types of works, aren't in the university system, even though the university system would kind of claim that, they teach you about the most preeminent and authoritative philosophers and scientists and scholars. But in a way, it's not true at all. They ignore these very profound issues.
And I know. And then I said, well, what I was saying was that I started talking about consciousness research, and I said, you know, I just don't see the evidence for this idea that the brain generates consciousness. It's just, you know, just not so.
Yeah.
And so there's this whole alternative perspective to all that, and within the esoteric teachings, and what's really, really troubling, I guess, in a way, is that, and I've been writing about this, and it just, the more I read about the what research exists out there and what ideas exist out there for people to consider, and the more I look at where consciousness research is, there's just this huge disconnect. I just don't understand where how people have arrived at these perspectives, and how they ignore the esoteric literature and don't study it and aren't aware of it. It's just really peculiar that these ideas aren't given consideration. And for instance, one thing I'm just writing about right now is that I've written about this before, but Peter Washington wrote a book called Madame Blavatsky's Baboon about, I don't know when that came out, about 12, 13 years ago, and he talked about the work of Madame Blavatsky and Gurdjieff and Rudolf Steiner and Krishnamurti, and what he talked about is how these spiritual figures brought Eastern spiritual teachings to the West, and how they had a profound effect on various people. But he's looking at it from a skeptical perspective and saying, how could these faux spiritual teachings have such an impact on people, and why were they so gullible? And he doesn't really deal with anything in the book about the teachings themselves. It's all sort of anecdotes and ad hominem attacks, and it's a weird book because there's a lot of really funny things in it. It's really well written, and it's a good book in some sense.
Yeah, enjoyable book.
Yeah, totally.
I enjoy it too.
But it's totally empty in terms of, like, it's not an intelligent discussion of any of these people in terms of their teachings. But the question I asked is, what's really interesting is, where is there critical literature looking at esoteric teachings on the nature of the psychology of consciousness and the existence of higher spiritual domains and spiritual dimensions? Where's the critical literature on this? Like, who's actually written about this and has provided a critical examination in which they take on these ideas and can prove that they're not true, or that they're incoherent, or that they're not based on reality? There isn't any literature that I know of. I mean, if there is, I'd really like to hear about it, because I'd really like to read it. But it's all this superficial dismissal of things that people don't. It's like they set up these straw men because they mischaracterize what people say, and then they attack their misrepresentations of what's been said, and then they come away and they're satisfied that they've done away with it. But it just doesn't exist. I mean, I've never seen a really interesting discussion of Gurdjieff's teaching where somebody actually took it apart and said, "Well, this isn't true."
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen all sorts of people say that he's, you know, that he's a con artist and he's a rascal and that he's, you know, he's a faux guru and he's this and he's that, and that is his bizarre ideas. And I've seen some really bizarre characterizations of what he said. Like, at one point, I don't know who it was. I don't think it was Washington. I think maybe it was Washington.
It was Washington.
Where he said that Gurdjieff's I don't know what he called.
No, he says Gurdjieff is fond of threes.
Oh, no, that's not what I was going to say. But,
I thought that was the funniest line.
Gurdjieff's thing was war, you know, and I'm thinking.
Oh, Gurdjieff's thing was war.
Yeah,
wow, he said that.
At the heart, his movement was war, and I'm thinking, well, actually, the war against sleep, but it wasn't war. I mean, that's a complete distortion. I was like, no, that's completely wrong. Yeah, at one point, Washington says that Gurdjieff was fond of threes. That's his,
that's so
that's
funny.
Discussion in that book of the law of three.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to be kidding. I mean, it's just so absolutely ridiculous. It's like I said, it's kind of like saying, well, Heisenberg was beset by uncertainty and Einstein was into light. You know?
Yeah.
It's just totally absurd. But as I say, where is this? I mean, it would be really good if somebody would teach a course in the university and examine these teachings and, you know, try to get people to think critically about them. That would be a start. I mean, I would welcome anybody saying, well,
yeah.
Funny thing is, and this is the really interesting thing, is if you look at people who, like Sheldrake and Capra and David Bohm and Brian Josephson and Dr. Ravi Ravindra, and you start looking at these people who are scientists, Charles Tart, who are scientists by training, who have come to some sort of interest and explanations of their own disciplines in terms of spiritual and esoteric teachings, they've all studied something.
Yeah.
You know, they've all involved themselves with these teachings. Like Sheldrake went and lived in an ashram in India, you know, and studied meditation. And Josephson studied meditation. And Bohm had an interest in Krishnamurti's work and had a friendship with him and with the Dalai Lama and spoke with spiritual teachers. He was a Marxist. I mean, he was about the farthest thing from a spiritual person by training and inclination. And yet, you know,
David Bohm?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, he was blacklisted, actually. That was part of his problem. It's interesting that the people who do, and Kapper was into the study of Eastern religions and practiced Tai Chi and was into Taoism. And, you know, I mean, all of these people have explored these things, have come away and said, oh, you know, it's very interesting what's here, you know.
It's interesting. Like, seems to me is that a lot of the Western scientific approach to the study of consciousness has been carried out by overly intellectual people who then approach the study of consciousness like using the mind and then subsequently identifying the consciousness with the mind in the head because they're mainly intellectually centered. That's to me how I see part of it, is that it's this kind of Western psychologists and scientists have used a mental approach to understand consciousness and then confused the consciousness with the mental processes themselves. That's kind of how I see it. It even goes back to Descartes, who kind of says, I think, therefore I am. And in a way, that's a ridiculous kind of logic. Well, I mean, in a way, I can see his point. But in a way, it gives emphasis to the thinking. In a way, I am first. And because of my I am-ing, then there's a possibility for the capacity to think. But the I am doesn't follow from the thinking, even though he's not intending it quite in that way. I mean, he's saying, I think, therefore there has to be some I.
But you know, as has been pointed out by people from the esoteric tradition, is that, you know, the problem is that thinking is in many ways is the one of the obstacles to higher thinking. And I mean, you can be more conscious by not thinking. That's where the confusion comes, is that people equate consciousness with thinking.
Exactly. And yeah.
Thinking is not consciousness, and consciousness.
Exactly.
Is consciousness. That's the problem.
That's why I like Yogananda's definition of yoga. He defines it as the neutralization of the incessant vritti or thought waves. So for yoga, it's exactly what you're saying. It's like suspending the turning of the mind is necessary in order to experience deeper states of consciousness. So it's like suspending what most Western scientists think is the consciousness, like the turning of the mind. So
yeah,
exactly. And that we identify the consciousness with that. And I do see, like, I think a lot of these academics, like you know, Husserl and the phenomenologists, like, they had very, very intellectual, kind of confabulated intellectual approach to consciousness and kind of theoretical argument. That's what I find. I read someone like Dennett.
It's exactly.
So mentally abstracted, but he doesn't deal with, like, the essence of what is consciousness in any kind of immediate way, trying to approach it.
Well, he doesn't believe it exists. So, I mean, but yeah, it's like he reasons it away. It's like I remember reading Husserl way back when when I was an undergraduate, and thinking, like, it was so intellectual and so coherent in its own way, but it was like he could make perfect sense and not tell you anything meaningful. Like, it was weird, you know. Like, it always reminds me, like, Dennett reminds me of the old Woody Allen joke about he was dating a philosophy major in college, and she proved to him that he didn't exist, you know. That's kind of like these guys. It's like his verbal gymnastics to prove something that, you know, is patently ridiculous, you know, that experience would do away with in a moment. And that's the problem with the approach. But again, it's like, it's funny, like, I was reading Dr. Ravindra's, has a very interesting paper on yoga, consciousness and reality, I think it's called it. He's talking about the yogic aphorisms of Patanjali, and Patanjali talks about Purusha, which is the real seer, and how, you know, we have to stop the activities of the mind so that Purusha becomes active, and Purusha is the real seer. We don't really see with our normal waking consciousness that we see Prakriti, we see the nature in its external manifestations, but the real seer is situated within, and by being quiet and by calming the waves of the mind, that the real seer emerges, which is Purusha, and then you have real seeing, and that's sort of the, you know, the thousands and thousands of years old refutation of what Descartes was asserting, because Descartes, you know, it leads to, like, this emphasis on cognition and that the eye is cognition. I mean, Carl Sagan says at one point in his writings that what's distinctly human is thinking. It's quite likely that animals have all sorts of deep emotions, but thinking is what really distinguishes human beings from all other animals.
Yeah, well, I think that's really important and true. Like, in Blavatsky, man comes from manas, to think. And that's like how Gurdjieff says, like, man is a three-brained being.
Yeah.
We function mentally, emotionally, and physically. So man has these faculties of manas, like capacities for cognition and mind knowing. Yeah.
But the problem with what he's saying is that, I mean, I agree with that too, is that, yeah, thinking is distinct, but the problem is that consciousness is what really, I think, sets and the capacity for self-consciousness is what is really the distinctive feature of human beings, is that they possess that capacity to develop and realize self-consciousness, and consciousness is nothing. And that's what he doesn't see, and that's what really the whole sort of Western tradition over the last 300-400 years has completely missed, is that consciousness is not to be equated with the contents of awareness or with any faculty of the brain.
Yeah, of the mind and cognition, yeah. And that's exactly what Western psychology has done. Like, you just see that in how frequently the books on the nature of human consciousness, they all have a picture of the head on the front cover. And then who was it, Jim? You said there was that one woman who had her book, and she had, like, about rows of brains on the front.
She had two brains. That's Conversations on Consciousness, Susan Blackmore.
Oh, two brains on the front.
Yeah.
Because Conversations on Consciousness. Yeah.
So it's doubly smart and doubly human. It's completely ridiculous, though. That's the problem with it. It's like, it's not true, you know. But as you say, yeah, it's like, you wanna, if you're gonna have a book on consciousness, well, I guarantee you that you're gonna have an illustration of a brain on it. It's funny because I've got all these books here in my library. I'm looking at, you know, brain, you know. It's like very odd. Nobody ever puts a heart on that. You know, that's interesting.
Yeah, except for me.
Yeah, you.
But,
well,
I mean, you said earlier, if only someone kind of like, well, I mean, I do critique the Western traditions and try to show, like in my book, The Heart Doctrine, I try to provide a critique of Western psychology and try to explain how they attempt to account for consciousness. Like, there's different theories and models of it. Even within science itself, everybody admits it's the greatest unsolved enigma of modern psychology and science is the issue of consciousness. But still, the assumption always is that it's centered in the head. But in the Heart Doctrine book, I think I show that perspective, and then I explain enough of the Heart Doctrine that you, even if you, like, I wouldn't want someone to believe or accept the Heart Doctrine, but what the book definitely does is it poses it as an alternative viewpoint that is both rational, intelligible, and in ways, I would say, far more consistent with inner self-experiencing if anyone tries to explore consciousness in themselves. Because I believe if you try to explore the nature of consciousness within yourself, it becomes obvious to you that it's not just centered up in the head, in the mind. There's something much more complicated of how consciousness can be experienced throughout ourselves. I mean, we see this in even something, we look at yoga, Jim, and the teachings of the chakras and that. I mean, though that system spreads consciousness all through the body, like through the winds associated with the different channels and so on. Yeah. Like, it's only in Western psychology that they've kind of locked consciousness up in the cerebral cortex. I mean, Carl Sagan in The Cosmos in 1980 says the cerebral cortex is where consciousness is transformed out of matter. And he says that in Cosmos, quote, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And which was, I mean, it sounds reasonable, but really there was not one iota bit of evidence for it. And in fact, it's completely contradictory to all other kinds of evidences. Like Penfield, who said back in 1936, it was shown conclusively that the cerebral cortex did not produce consciousness. That's what Penfield said 40 years earlier than Sagan.
Well, yeah, and in Dragons of Eden, he says that he will entertain in his consideration of the evolution of human intelligence, which is what the book is about, no idea about anything apart from the physical body and the brain, which a mind which affects anything. And he says at one point something to the effect that even though we can't explain everything now, you know, and there are some dissenting viewpoints, a few students of the brain-mind problem, you know, and the few students turned out to be like Penfield and Sir John Eccles and Sir Charles Sheridan and pre-Rome, I mean, like the preeminent neurologists of the 20th century, you know, all kind of, what's his name, Goldstein, the German neurologist, all put forth, you know, views that the brain and the mind are not identical, and that the brain doesn't produce mind, and yet, you know, he just sort of blithely says this as if it's sort of true. I got to tell you this is what just to go back a little bit to we were talking about Peter Washington's book. This is what he said about Gurdjieff, that Gurdjieff is part of the complementary fascination with barbarism and primitivism, which colors the politics of fascism and the works of art from Lawrence's novels to Stravinsky's early ballets.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, wait a minute. Gurdjieff's doctrine, that's what the word was, doctrine was war, and his method of teaching was to stir up productive strife with all the means at his disposal. Well, the last part of that sentence is totally true, and all the rest is complete bullshit. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like, what? Complementary fascination with barbarism and primitivism. which
wow, that is absolutely bizarre.
Yeah, isn't it?
Really?
Has he actually ever read anything by Gurdjieff, or does he know anything about him? I mean, that's complete nonsense.
Yeah, it really is, totally.
My reply was, in light of such abject nonsense, it's difficult to know where one might begin in responding to Washington's torturous distortions and delusions. How anyone could possibly equate anything in Gurdjieff's teaching, or even in his methods, which were admittedly sometimes harsh and extreme, with barbarism, primitivism, or fascism, is completely beyond my understanding. I was like,
yeah, really?
I was like, where would you get that?
Goodness sake.
Yeah.
Wow,
that was a bestseller.
Well, it was a fun book. I mean,
we
both enjoyed it because we're interested in, you know, the stories of people like Gurdjieff and Krishnamurti and Blavatsky. So it was a good book to read from that perspective because he had interesting anecdotes and things like that. But it's like what you were saying. When it comes to their addressing the actual substance of what these people taught, there's absolutely no academic consideration or scientific consideration.
Yeah.
It's more writing about their personality and their life and times, and
yeah, and a very distorted account of that too. You know, his depiction of Krishnamurti is just like this really spoiled guy who just, you know, really dupe people, and I mean, I think it's incredibly unfair and distorted picture of Krishnamurti, and like everybody who studied with Gurdjieff was basically a dope, according to him, like a hapless dupe, and it's just like completely ridiculous, you know.
Yeah, he seemed to have that perspective, like, why do rational people believe irrational things? Like, to have that attitude, like Michael Schwirmer, or whatever, who's the fellow, the PsyCop fellow, Michael
Schirmer? He's a skeptic.
Yeah, skeptic. Like
why people believe irrational things. Yeah, he was I think he was like a fundamentalist Christian.
Oh.
He was brought up that way, and then he, you know, turned to science and saw through the error of his ways. But it's like, well, yeah, okay, you know, there are other alternatives, you know. that's what's so funny, and that's where, again, they're getting back to this formatory thinking, is that the whole religion versus science debate is completely formatory. There is no
exactly, yeah,
no
but it's a false dichotomy.
Yeah, it's no such thing as religion, and there's no such thing as science. Like, they aren't these monoliths that are opposed to one another. There are all sorts of different levels of religion, and there are all sorts of different levels and perspectives on science. You can be a scientist and not believe in materialist, mechanistic, reductionist approach to the study and explanations of reality, and you can be a highly spiritual person and be quite interested in scientific ideas and you know, trying to reach an integration. Or you can be a fundamentalist who just believes like that the literal truth of what's in the Bible or some other holy book. I mean, and there's all sorts of different gradations and levels in between. I mean, it's just so ridiculous. Like, it's a debate between. It's a debate between like two different straw men. You know, it's just like
two different straw men, yeah. Because it also what people, like, people don't see how much of what we think is science is really quack science. And it's not, like, it's the interpretation of the data that makes it, like, quack science. Like, a scientist would say that, oh, materialist philosophy is, like, real science. But no, that's quack science. I mean, it's a philosophy, but it's not science. What am I trying to say? I see a lot of what we consider to be science is really quack science. It's based on faulty assumptions, and we don't stick to the data. And then you can look at, like, I mean, I run the Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Science. So what I'm saying is that we need to try to search out the scientific basis for different mystical and religious concepts to look at those in the scientific way, not just as belief systems or dogmas, but as like trying to apprehend the significance of some of the concepts that come from religion. Like, to me, the most important concept that comes from a religion is that human consciousness originates from some type of spiritual or soul nature within the human being, and that we're not simply biological material beings, and there is a possibility for existence apart from the body and afterlife. So a scientist might think, oh, well, that's not scientific. What am I trying to say about that? But to approach it, it's a scientific issue. Like, what is the origin and nature of human consciousness? And the scientists have their belief that it's produced by the material brain. But that's not scientifically established. That's an assumption within science that limits their perspective on their issue. But so to say the brain produces consciousness, I would say that is quack science. That's not established by science.
Yeah, Stanislav Grof says it's one of the two great epistemological assumptions of Western science and thinking is that the brain produces consciousness. It is an assumption, and there is no evidence.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I ran into this. I went to this. There's an association, Brain Injury Association group in Peel Region. That my friend is the acting director, and he's a lawyer. And I went to a function they had the other night, and I ran into a lady there who's I think she's the director of or is on the executive of the Toronto Brain Injury Association. And we had met at one of our law firm's functions a couple of years ago, and I said, oh, yeah, we met. And she said, oh, yeah, I remember you. And she said, you were telling me there's more. She remembered what I was telling her, that it's not all in the brain about consciousness and awareness, and that it doesn't necessarily originate in the brain. You have a very good memory. So I think I made an impression on her with that idea. But it's funny how, like, people just... You know, I mean, it's the same thing like the left brain, right brain. It's so many aspects of this have just been kind of conditioned. People talk about, well, that part of my brain doesn't work. I hear that all the time, you know, or, you know,
yeah.
I this about my brain, and, you know, people identify everything with their brains, I feel at times like saying you realize that, you know, there's absolutely... I mean, I think if you say to people, like, there's no scientific evidence that your brain produces your consciousness and awareness, they'd look at you like you had three heads, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you'd be three times, you'd have, like some sort of cover of a book on consciousness. I mean, it's just so ingrained in people's thinking, and it's become such a dominant assumption in Western science. And yet, as you say, I think there are more and more people who are coming to realize that, you know, this just isn't the case. And again, reading that book by Dr. Van Lommel is really interesting, because it's interesting that the near-death experience research, I think, is, like, to me, more and more, the more I read about it, it's just so compelling, it's so interesting, because there's a case where if you take the standard conventional set of assumptions about the relationship of the brain and the mind, science, that scientific perspective would predict that when someone dies and is pronounced clinically dead, and so there or is, has a cessation of all brain activity in terms of, like, no EEG activity whatsoever, and the heart is stopped, what would science predict would happen in terms of that person's experience? Well, there's no doubt what science would predict. Nothing.
No memory. Yeah,
there would be no experience, because there's no brain activity. There's no brain activity even in the lower brainstem activity. There's nothing. Okay, so there's no brain activity, and the heart is stopped. So what can a person experience? Nothing. But mystical and esoteric teachings are very consistent. It's like there's a withdrawal of consciousness into the higher dimensions. And that's exactly what people report repeatedly. Like, not once, not twice, not 50 times, not 100 times, not 1,000 times, thousands and thousands of these cases, and more of them emerging all the time. And all of these people, so many legitimate researchers who have gone into this to disprove this, or who've gone in skeptically, have been completely converted. They've come to Jesus in terms of this and realized, like, oh, this isn't explainable in terms of it's not anoxia. I mean, it's interesting, like in Dr. Van Lommel's book, he talks about the importance, like there is a physiological component. It seems like the release of DMT, like that molecule, is important, you know. But I mean, it's very clear that there's something going on here which is so outside the pale of normal scientific explanation, that there's something clearly and dramatically wrong. And if it was just that, I would be a little bit more cautious. But what's so striking is that it's so consistent, what these people describe is so consistent with mystical and esoteric conceptualizations of experiences of samadhi and higher states of transcendent consciousness, cosmic consciousness, whatever you want to call it, but experiences that transcend our normal waking consciousness. And people describe the same things. Swedenborg was describing this 300 years ago. Yogananda was describing it 50 years ago. You know, I mean, you go through the entire mystical literature. There's literally hundreds and thousands of cases of descriptions of this. So, I mean, there's clearly something seriously wrong with the existing model, that it just doesn't withstand scrutiny. And I mean, we're not arguing any of this because we have a vested interest. It's not like we own shares in the Heart Foundation or something. We're trying to find out what's going on here, and we're trying to come to some sort of truth. And I mean, I think we all have our prejudices and our pet theories and our inclinations, I think. But I think you and I are basically open-minded about this and have been for like 40 years, right? And that's what I find really disturbing in so much of the skeptical and conventional scientific response, is that there's just like this closed-mindedness and this like intellectual laziness and denial, that the people don't want to look what's out at what's there.
Yeah, even to the point of like considering it then as a hypothesis, and that's what a scientist would do. Like, a real scientist wouldn't just, oh, that's impossible, you know, Professor Husserl would never, whatever. To at least consider it as hypothesis, instead of, like, that's one thing that I see scientists do that, to me, makes it appear that they're quack scientists, is that they dismiss all these kinds of evidences on a completely superficial basis and won't consider it. So it's like they're quack scientists. Like one of the things that most struck me about the near-death experiences is how, when these people claim to be apart from their body, they were still sensorially aware, because they could actually see their body and see things in the operating theater or an accident scene. So they were still sensing. They still had memory, because they kind of knew who they were. Like, they didn't lose, they knew that was their body, and they had memory of like who they were and who the people were around them. So they still had personal memory. They still had thoughts, because they think about these things, and they're still conscious. And a lot of these people say they report feeling almost completely themselves, almost completely the same as when they're in the body, which, to me, that is really important insight, because that suggests that even when we're in our body, it was never the physical body that created that inner thinking and feeling and sensation and so on. Instead, it's like the living entity inhabits the body. And that, I thought, was very, very significant, that a person, even apart from their body, they're still thinking, feeling, sensing, memory, personal identity, and consciousness. In fact, they feel almost completely themselves, completely apart from the body. I believe it's possible, because I believe consciousness is supported by these other subtle bodies, like the astral and mental body. So you can still be thinking and feeling and have memory and be conscious apart from your body, because you have other subtle bodies, your vehicles of awareness. So another thing I've heard scientists say who try to dismiss all the psychical research. Now I'm losing what I was trying to say about it. Anyway, that I remember that had a profound effect on me when I read that statement, Jim. It was in Ian Curry's book, You Cannot Die, about people feeling exactly the same.
Yeah.
And that really affected me, because I wanted to know, if that's true, like as a working hypothesis, then it suggests, wow, there's something fundamentally different going on here. And the idea of there being subtle being bodies is like what you say, that's throughout the mystical literature, that we don't just have a physical body, but we have, you know, astral mental bodies, and different people elaborate the bodies and such differently. But that basic concept is found throughout the mystical literature, that there are different bodies.
Yeah, as I say, that I guess the other part of it too is that, I mean, then there's when people do pass into the higher dimensions, there are these elements that recur, and the most striking ones are like the idea of the life review, and the effect that this experience has on people is that they generally tend to lose their fear of death, and they come away with a feeling of the essential all rightness of the universe, which are the sort of hallmarks of the traditional accounts of mystical experiences, and certainly are what's transmitted by people in esoteric traditions who have realized higher states of consciousness and being like more permanent states, talk about how things from the perspective of higher dimensions take on an entirely different sense of meaning, and you understand things that are sort of invisible and not manifest on the physical realm. And I guess, like, what strikes me is it's the consistency of these. I mean, not everybody has the same experience, and you wouldn't actually expect that. You know, we don't all have to have the same experiences in life, so why would we have the same experiences in death? But there are like these recurring elements that are so striking in people's accounts. And then there's like the aftermath, like the immediate, like the out of body perspective, where people, as you say, there are accounts of people providing incredibly accurate explanations of the procedures that medical personnel carried out on them, people who are not sophisticated, and people who have these experiences do better than control groups, where people are asked to generate accounts and they make mistakes, they don't know what they're talking about, and the people who do have these experiences are accurate and describe tools that are used and medical instruments. And so, you know, the overwhelming aspect of these things is of these accounts and the sheer number of them is like to me is like this massive evidence. Is like Uspensky said, if we added up all of the anomalies and all of the enigmas and mysteries, and you know, like to kind of overwhelm the conventional understanding of things, I think that's especially true of the in consciousness research and literature. Is I think, if you have a really comprehensive perspective, which I think is really articulated very well in your work, as a much more comprehensive approach to the study of consciousness in your work than anything else that I know of, because it includes modern psychological perspectives and the ancient esoteric teachings and the paranormal, and all of these ideas are presented, and there's a discussion and a comparison and contrasting of things throughout your work on these ideas. Then I think this conclusion is just inescapable, that we have to come to a very radically different understanding. And it's not just of consciousness, it's basically the nature of reality. So it's like our physics has to allow for metaphysics, and you know, we have to reconceive of ourselves as being like these multidimensional beings who live in this multidimensional universe. It's like I was reading from The Secret Doctrine, where Blavatsky talks about, you know, the idea of these other dimensions. She says we reject the idea of the higher and lower, but rather what's happening is that these different worlds interpenetrate one another. So within us, within our very beings, there's all these different worlds that are interpenetrating one another, which is like, that's exactly what Gurdjieff says too. It's like, but it's so like hard to even kind of fathom that, because it's just so against what everything we've been taught. And yet, you know, those ideas recur again in the mystical and esoteric literature. Well, I just wanted to say one thing too while I think of it. A few weeks ago, I was talking about Michael Sabam, the cardiologist who'd done near-death research, and I don't know where I got the idea he was French. He's not French at all. He's an American, and he did a big study called the Atlanta Project with the Veterans Hospital in Atlanta, and I think he actually teaches in Florida now. So my apologies to him. He's not French at all. I don't know. I could totally confabulate at that. So, but as I say, I just don't see how anybody can look at these, look at all of this research and all of this data, and try to reduce it to this. It just doesn't fit, you know. It doesn't fit at all.
Well, and it's funny because I find when I look at the skeptics' arguments and books and read their articles and PsyCop magazine and Skeptic magazine, I find that the debunkers are like totally superficial scientifically and like make the most egregious kinds of dismissals and commentary on other people's work. And then you often see in rebuttals, it's like the skeptics are even, like, what they show is their quack science, in my view.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I do think it's useful to be skeptical and inquiring and critical and pose alternative hypotheses, all of these things. But when I look at how they do that, like, it's ridiculous. Like, it's like Carl Sagan when he talks of experiences of being out of the body, and he says, oh, how this could be related to the birth experience, and how when you're born and the doctor lifts you up and you fly through the air, and that's seeing God. And he has this whole analogy of how the memories of birth are supposed to kind of explain these phenomena. And he has this whole argument, which is like so superficial and ignores so many essential aspects of it. But then it's like for Carl Sagan, the fact that he's offered an alternate rational explanation means that there's no longer anything to explain now. Even though he doesn't provide any evidence that to support what he's saying, his interpretation, it's like he doesn't think he has to provide any evidence. All he's got to do is come up with the possible alternate rational explanation.
Yeah, and grounded in materialism, and that's the thing is that I believe in being skeptical, and I've said this before on this program, is that when skeptics address parapsychological research and they poke a billion holes in it and say, well, they could have done this and they could have done that, and you need to do this, and that's good because all research should be criticized, but basically you have to realize that. If you applied those standards to almost all psychological research, almost all of it would fail too. You know, it's very hard, very hard. We both know this because we've both done it, to design a very good experiment.
And to
carry it out. I mean, it's really, really difficult. And it's that much more difficult when you're trying to examine something that you don't really understand, like parapsychological phenomena. And yet, you know, when you look at I think Dean Radin's books are really important, where he does this meta statistical analysis of all of the paranormal research, and what he finds is that not only are the results statistically significant to document these phenomena, like when you compare them to things like that people believe in implicitly, like the idea that aspirin prevents heart attacks, the correlations are a lot stronger for the idea I'm trying to think of
extrasensory perception,
or
psychokinesis,
psychokinesis. Even maybe the most dramatic one is all of these phenomena. There's a much stronger, research that in terms of statistically than there is for a lot of things that we take to be, you know, scientific facts. And I yeah. read a thing recently in the New York Review of Books where somebody had done an analysis of medical research and found that 50% of it was not replicated in other laboratories.
Wow.
50%.
Wow.
There's a European
wow.
guy had done this like mammoth study of medical. And of course, you know, let's face it. I mean, scientists always like maintain, well, that, you know, the self-correction capacity of science is what sets it apart from faith-based religion. But when money enters the equation, you know, facts become much more malleable, and there's a ton of friggin' money underlying most scientific research, and especially mm-hmm. medical research is paid and bought for by drug companies amongst the,
yeah.
the,
yeah, the big pharmaceuticals.
And
yeah.
a lot of it is completely suspect.
Yeah.
So, I mean, again...
Yeah, I was thinking, imagine if you, in order for a new pharmaceutical drug to be manufactured and given a license, imagine if you had to compare it objectively with a health regimen of a nutritionist and a kind of natural health healer. Imagine that. Like, I mean, when they research their drugs, it's just to show that it only kills a minimum of their victims or something. It doesn't, you know, they never have to show, like, their drug should have more benefits than what you could accrue by simple nutritional, factors and health supplements. Hey,
yeah.
Don't you see what I'm saying? Like,
yeah
because
yeah,
why introduce this foreign synthesized substance? You should at least show that it's more valuable than just a natural health regimen. And then I bet you if you had that kind of real analysis of these drugs, there wouldn't be many drugs getting into market. I noticed we're coming down, Jim. We just got a couple minutes here.
You never mentioned your website, by the way.
Oh, yeah, so I will do that. I haven't worked on my website for a couple of weeks. I still have my tribute to Karen up there, and I'm going to kind of move it to a back page and move on and revitalize my website and put up some new material from the Slugs. I would encourage people to order a new copy of the Slugs. I think it's a profoundly valuable book. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. I'd like to thank BBS Radio. We had a pretty broad kind of ranging discussion, Jim, today. Amazing. I felt tired when we began, but we can always talk so easy.
Yeah, I was tired too, so it got going a little bit. And, I mean, it's... there's so many different topics to discuss, and we come back to some of the same things over and over again. But it's kind of like you have to do that to sort of provide the foundation of where we're coming from on a lot of these issues. So.
Yeah, we do have to do that. That's so right, because as people listen to us over time, they learn the language and they learn. You know, it does take repetition and to hear things. I mean, I just know how much we go over the same things and we understand them ourselves ever more deeply as we go back over them. I've always experienced that.
Yeah, it's fun to try to figure out different ways of expressing things too, because you make new connections and you see things that you haven't seen before. So, yeah, very interesting process.
Okay, so we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And thanks, Jim. Thanks, BBS Radio. Encourage people in the audience, make an effort to remember yourself, and let's try to wake up and bring about a more healthier and more productive world. Okay. Thanks all. Goodbye.